get started tonight, there's something I want to share with you. Lee and I were talking about different approaches in different places, over in East Europe and such, and I mentioned to him what I was going to try in Philadelphia. And as we got to talking about it, on the way over, I asked Bertina and Luke, should I show one of these tonight? And they both said yes. So it's pretty short, but I want to share it with you, and I'll explain why. If you don't like it, stone the women and child over there. All right, Mark says yes, too. So you can have rocks going at three people. Just not me, please. But it's something that might be of some benefit to you up here, and so I want to share it with you. Earlier this summer, at one of the camps, John was very instrumental in the Soul Camp in making that possible, and in Gary's camp over in Indiana, a friend of ours, Caleb Churchill, filmed a little clip from one of the classes on evidences and put it on YouTube, and I was intrigued to watch. It was getting shared and shared and shared and shared, and I realized part of the reason it was getting shared was because it was very, very short. It's like we're a nation of ADD people now. And I got to thinking about it and just how much now when we want information, we go to the Internet. And the Internet has good stuff. It has horrible stuff. It's got neutral stuff. But I got to think about, like, if somebody sends you a clip and it's 18 minutes long, you're not going to look at it. And so I decided the clip that Caleb put on, it was 3 minutes and some odd seconds long. And I got to thinking about it, I thought that would be a good target time. And so for the last couple months, I've been working on some 3-minute Bible lessons, condensing stuff into 3 minutes. And that's one of the things we're going to be doing we'll be doing in Gettysburg until I go, and hopefully they can still use it there, and I'll be using it in Philadelphia. We'll have some business cards that have, April made the logo for it, it's 3minutebiblestudy.com, and it'll have a little QB code on it, so that if I just get a card to somebody as they're riding the metro or whatever, you know, as long as they got a signal where they do, they can just scan, and then 3 minutes. And so once it's up, hopefully they'll be coming out every Tuesday morning. I wanted to share one with you, and then if it's something that, you know, you think might be helpful to you here, once it's online, it'll be a YouTube channel and a website. And so if you can get people... And what I'll be doing in Gettysburg, Philadelphia, I'll be handing out cards that have our contact information and the website. So hopefully if they like the website, then they'll give us a call. And if it works out where it's something y'all might be interested in, you might be able to, you know, get your name on something to somebody. And if they see it, then they think, wow, I was able to learn some Bible there. And then hopefully they'll contact you and do that. So I'll show you one of them now. Let's see. This one is. This will be the first one that'll be up.
Welcome to 3-Minute Bible Study on Biblical History. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and God created man and woman. The creation was good. Then Adam and Eve rebelled and fell from God. Wickedness increased, and judgment came in the flood on all but Noah and those in the ark. Noah's descendants were dispersed at the Tower of Babel, and God chose Abram and his descendants to receive the promised land, to become a nation, and to bless all nations. The promise continued through Abraham's son Isaac and his son Jacob, also known as Israel. Jacob had 12 sons, one of which would rise to the right hand of power in Egypt. The Israelites came down to live in Egypt, but after Joseph's death, they became enslaved for about 400 years. God delivered them through Moses, who brought them out to Mount Sinai, where they received the law and the instructions for the tabernacle of God. But due to their unfaithfulness, they were detained in the wilderness for 40 years, and the next generation entered the promised land under Joshua. After Joshua, Israel was led by judges, the last of whom was Samuel, who anointed Saul, the first king of Israel. After Saul was rejected, God chose David to be king and promised that his son would be a son to God, would build a house to God, and his kingdom would be established forever. David's immediate son indeed built the temple, but the promise of a kingdom forever would be part of the messianic hope in Israel. After Solomon's death, the kingdom divided into the northern and southern kingdoms, which were largely unfaithful and ignored the prophet's calling for repentance. As prophesied, disobedient Israel and Judah both fell, Israel to Assyria in 721 BC and Judah to Babylon, along with the destruction of the temple in 586 BC. After the Babylonian captivity, many returned to the land with Zerubbabel and Ezra and rebuilt the temple. Nehemiah came later and rebuilt the city walls. 400 years pass, and Israel looks for the promised Messiah to come. The New Testament picks up in the first century with John the Baptist announcing that the kingdom of God is at hand. In John 1:29, he identifies Jesus of Nazareth as the Lamb of God that takes away the sins of the world. The four Gospels record the teaching of Jesus, his time with the apostles, and the miracles that identify Jesus as the Messiah, or Christ. At the end of his life, he establishes the Lord's Supper to commemorate his death. He surrenders to his enemies, and his disciples flee. Jesus is mocked, tortured, crucified, and buried. But on the third day, the tomb is found empty. He appears to the apostles, tells them to await the Holy Spirit and to be his witnesses to the world, then he ascends to the Father. Acts 2 records the day of Pentecost, when the Spirit falls on them and Peter preaches Jesus as the risen Christ. 3,000 Jews are baptized in the name of Jesus Christ for the remission of their sins on that day. The church continues to grow, but soon faces intense persecution from opponents like Saul, also known as Paul. But after an encounter with Jesus, Paul himself is converted and begins preaching Christ, and the gospel begins spreading far beyond Israel. Much of the rest of the New Testament contains letters from Paul, Peter, James, and John, etc. That's your 3-minute overview of Old Testament and New Testament history. For more info, go to 3MinuteBibleStudy.com.
So that's going to be the first one up. And I didn't click it quite at the right time there. But there's an introduction to Romans, an introduction to 1 Corinthians. There'll be some doctrinal questions, some evidences, things, and such like that. And I'm hoping to hit the golden time frame where you can get in enough information to catch somebody's attention, but have it short enough that they'll be willing to say, okay, I got 3 minutes. And so that hopefully will be up in about a week or so. All right, for our lesson tonight, last night we finished talking about husbands and wives, and not only the importance of husbands and wives being what they need to be for each other, but we set examples for our children all the time. And some days we're setting good examples, and some days we're not setting particularly good examples. Or in one part of the day we're setting a good example, and another part of the day we didn't set a good example. And those things have effects. A lot of who we are often depends on just habits and things that we learned growing up in our home. If you grow up in a home where nobody picks things up, then it won't be a big surprise if in the next home things aren't picked up. If you grow up in a home where nobody ever apologizes, don't be surprised if the people don't go out ready to apologize. If you grow up in a home where it's easy to get angry, it's going to be easier for the children to get angry. And so what we do right and what we do wrong has an effect on the children. Last night we talked about foundations of home and husbands. Tonight we're going to talk about wives and the kind of the atmosphere of the home. Ephesians chapter 5 in the environment. Paul says, wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church, his body, and is himself its Savior. Now, as the church submits to Christ, so also wives should submit in everything to their husbands. Needless to say, this is not a popular concept among a lot of people with feminist ideas and the erasing of gender roles that has happened in our society. Erasing of gender roles is not a good thing. Men are men and should be men. Women are women and should be women. And the world is better with both men and women in it. And if there weren't men and women in it, pretty soon it would be a world without neither. Because we would just die and that would be it. God established roles, and those roles are important. It's challenging. And this call for submission to your husband as unto the Lord, it's a challenge for people to be submissive to the Lord, because we can, our old nature can pop back up and we can want to be selfish. And so it's the right thing to do, but it takes self-denial and commitment to submit ourselves to the Lord, which is what we must do. But that is a little bit easier than submitting ourselves to another human for obvious reasons. The Lord's perfect. No husband is. And yet, this is what the text tells us to do. And of course, if you continue down in this passage, what is the next point made in Ephesians 6? Children, obey your parents in the Lord. Has there been a perfect parent? And yet we see the wisdom of why the children are to obey the parents. Children are not to decide, well, I would obey my parents if they were perfect, if they never made a mistake, but therefore, no, they still need to obey. And of course, then there's servants being subject to masters. And when we get to 1 Peter, you've got citizens being subjection to the government, servants being subjection to masters, wives being subjection to your husbands. One of the curious things is this. A lot of women have told their husbands, I'm not going to be in subjection to you. I'm not going to be told what to do. I'm not going to have a man tell me what to do. And so they go out into the career world and they get a job like everybody else. And there's at least a 50-50 chance their boss is going to be male, which means they're going to be having to do what a man said to do. Oh, but it's for money. Why does money make something more honorable? You know, there's a lot of people that look down at mothers. You know, you mothers who have, when a baby is born, and if you mothers will remember, you know, when you took that newborn baby and God put the instinct in that baby, you know, it'd be right there for you and ready for you. And just that bonding that's there. And then and being able to mold a human being. We know the old saying, the hand that rocks the cradle rules the world. But there are people that look down on that and they say, I don't want to spend my time, you know, changing diapers and taking care of. But you know what is considered honorable? If you start a business that's a daycare. And guess what's going to have to be done there? Babies are going to have to be watched. Diapers are going to have to be changed. But now it's honorable because how did it become honorable? Because somebody's loving, caring for a baby for money instead of raising a child out of love. But there's submission there, and there needs to be submission to the husband. Now, a lot of wives might say this, well, I am usually submissive, especially when I agree, you know. Is that submission? If you are ever driving down the road and you notice that another car in front of you or behind you is making the same turns, you might begin to wonder, are they going to the same place I am? Or are they following me? You turned right on Main, it turned right on Main. You turned left on Locust, it turned left on Locust. You got in the interstate ramp, it got on the interstate ramp. You took exit 42, it took exit 42, and you begin to wonder. But then you come up to a Y, and it went this way, and you went that way. At that point, what do you realize? They weren't following you. They just coincidentally happened to be wanting to take part of the same route as you. But as soon as you went a different way, they went on their own way. That's not following. And doing what your husband wants when it's what you wanted to do anyway is not submission. You know, if you work for a boss that way, you know, it's, I do what you want, boss, as long as it's what I already wanted. That's not service. That's not what children are to do. Submission involves self-denial. We all need submission, and we will all be in submission to someone. Even if you are the President of the United States, you're going to be in submission to the voters when you run again. And if the voters say no, you're out. 1 Peter chapter 3, let's turn to that passage, verse 1 through 6. In like manner, this is in this section, recall, where he's told citizens or subjects, because not everybody was a citizen of the Roman Empire, subjects are to be in submission to the government, governors and kings, obey their laws. Servants are to obey the masters. Wives, in like manner, you wives, be in subjection to your own husbands, that even if any obey not the word, they may without the word be gained by the behavior of their wives, beholding your chaste behavior coupled with fear. I recall one fellow that used to give his wife a rough time about being a Christian and made it difficult sometimes for her. And sometimes she was weak and didn't do well, but then her resolve got stronger and stronger, and he knew she was going to follow the Lord. But there was just this tension, and she was determined and determined and determined. Well, eventually, he decided to become a Christian. And then the question was asked him, why did he give her a rough time before? You know, this is now it's something he wants to do. Why had he done this when this is, because, and he explained that he had been jealous. He wished he was a good person, and he wasn't. And he knew his wife was. It's kind of like, I would like to play the banjo. I will never play the banjo. Theoretically, I would like to play the banjo and speak Spanish. Not necessarily at the same time, but there's just two things. If it didn't take commitment, I would just like to have those two abilities. There are people that do those because they did what? They made a commitment to that. He wished he was a good person but hadn't been willing to make a commitment, and he saw it in his wife. He was jealous of that, respected it. But you can see how that respect and resentment kind of combines. And so one of the ways a woman can influence her husband is by having her behavior proper. And listen what it is. Be gained by the behavior of their wives, beholding your chaste behavior, pure behavior, coupled with fear, whose adorning let it not be the outward adorning of the braiding of hair, wearing jewels, or putting on apparel. Let it be the hidden man of the heart in the incorruptible apparel of a meek and quiet spirit, which is in the sight of God of great price. So much of the emphasis in the past and now and in our culture is on external appearances. And a lot of, you know, by the time you get the fake eyelashes on and the piercings in and everything, that's not where it's to be. It's not to be the outward adorning of the clothes and jewels and gold and putting on of apparel. It's the heart in the incorruptible apparel of a meek and quiet spirit. Last night we talked about divorce statistics, and that about half of all marriages are ending in divorce. And sometimes those happen very quickly. I remember one case where, I mean, in 6 months, you know, the marriage was ending. They still probably looked like they did 6 months earlier. If you don't have character and if you don't have commitment to the marriage, to each other, to God, all those other things can become very inconsequential, very quick. What matters is this inner heart, this incorruptible apparel, for the woman's case, of a meek and quiet spirit, which is in the sight of God of great price. And so there are questions that a husband needs to ask himself when looking at the other passages. A question a wife needs to ask you, do I have a meek and quiet spirit? Or is it a rebellious spirit? After this woman aforetime, the holy women also who hoped in God adorned themselves, being in subjection to their own husbands, as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, whose children you now are, if you do well and are not put in fear by any terror. And so do you see in the example of Sarah, just in her words and the way she spoke to her husband, the recognition there that she gave him. Verse 7, ye husbands, in like manner, dwell with your wives according to knowledge. Some Bible say, with understanding. So the wife is to be in subjection to the husband. The husband is to dwell with the wife according to knowledge. And it says, giving honor unto the woman as unto the weaker vessel, as also being joint heirs of grace of life, to the end that your prayers be not hindered. I want to say something first about the weaker vessel thing. It could mean more than one thing. I'm going to tell you what I think it means, and it may involve more than one thing. It may be broader than I'm suggesting. It could be definitely a reference to the physical difference in strength. Most men are usually bigger and stronger on average than women. And so it could refer to that. And because of the roles given, the woman is more of the nurturer in raising the children, whereas the man needs to be able to go out and work and such. You can see how that kind of fits. But I'm not sure that's the point here. I think another point to notice is this. In each role of subjection here, there was a citizen or subject before a governor or king. Who's the weaker person? In authority, it's the citizen. I don't have the power of the governor of Pennsylvania. If I did, my real estate property taxes would be a lot lower than they are, or even the county commissioners or school board or whatever. The servant and the master, who's in the weaker position, authority-wise? It's the servant. Fellas, have you ever worked for a boss who you happen to be physically stronger than? Probably so. But that didn't make you the boss. He's the boss. If it's his company, he started it, he writes the paychecks, he's the boss. You might be more intelligent than the governor or the mayor or the president, but they're still the governor, the mayor, the president. And so a wife might be smarter than her husband, she might be physically stronger than her husband, but in the role of authority, she's in the weaker position. So what's important for husbands to do, one thing, is live with understanding that you've got somebody depending on you for that. If you're a boss, and so other people's lives are strongly affected on how ethically you treat your employees and how fairly you treat them, what should you do? You should realize this makes a difference, and so you should do it in an honorable way. If you're a governor, you should do that. If we're a husband, we should realize somebody is depending on us to provide leadership, and so instead of abusing leadership, think about what it would be like if it was reversed. You know, if God called halftime and said, switch into the field from now on, why husbands be in subjection to your wives? We're going to try it that way for a while. If that's what the Lord said, that's what we would need to do. At that point, guys, what would we be interested in? what kind of a head is she going to be? What kind of, is she going to honor me? Is she going to respect me? Is she going to take my feelings into consideration? Or is she going to just, you know, step all over me? So bring it back. Dwell with the wife according to understanding, and give honor to the weaker vessel. The wife in Proverbs chapter 31, look at some of the things here. An excellent wife, her worth is far above rubies. The heart of her husband trusts in her. She does him good and not evil all the days of her life. And that's why the heart of her husband trusts in her. She stretches out her hands to the needy, verse 20. She looks well to the ways of her household, verse 27. Remember Ralph, householder clothed in scarlet? Strength and dignity are her clothing. You know, you saw her getting up early and working late. The law of kindness is on her tongue, is the way the American Standard Version puts it. The law of kindness is not always the easiest thing to be on the tongue of a wife and mom and mother. Sometimes life gets pretty stressful. And sometimes it can become sarcastic, it can become nagging, it can become murmuring, it can become complaining. And what effect does that have on the family? It's, men and children tend to kind of tune out nagging. It's one of those things that, like a lot of other things for children or husbands or other people, there's a pattern that's easy to slip into, but it's not productive. And nagging is one of those things that's easy to slip into, but it's not necessarily very productive. You know, when that voice, when mom's voice starts to get a certain way, that's not what gets the children's attention as well, or their hearts as well, or the husband's focus in his respect as well. And when and you know that kind of a day, and guys, I remember one time I was, oh, it was such a frustrating day. We were moving, and it seemed like we had most of the stuff, a lot of stuff out of the house. On the day before the move, I went to the storage place, you know, where you put your stuff in storage, because we were about to leave the country, and the gates were locked. I've got closing in the morning, and the gates are locked at the storage thing. Later, I was able to get in, but I'm behind schedule now, and I worked all night, and it seemed like that last stuff, it's like the loaves and fishes. It just keeps multiplying. You know, it seems like all the rooms are empty, but still there's still that, and that, and that, and that. We went to close, and said, we're still not done. So they came about an hour and a half afterwards. They're sitting out here in their car. I'm trying to get stuff out. I put all the stuff in this big, you know, giant box. It's full of styrofoam peanuts and dust and dirt. Probably swept out and got the dirt out and everything. And then I leave, and then I come back. I set it out in front of the property. They pull in, I leave. I come back later to get it. It starts raining. I get a flat tire. I'm out changing the tire in the rain. I go, I pick up the box. My now it's wet, and the bottom just rips out. You know, and it's just that we all have some days like that sometimes. And if you're having a day like that as mom, and this has gone wrong, that has gone wrong, the kids are squabbling, you've just changed the baby, and now she threw up all over the dress, you know, everything's going wrong. Your husband has done some knucklehead thing, and you're really frustrated. It's easy to do what? As the tension and frustration go, it's easy to just get that kind of self-pitying, angry, you know, nagging voice going. And what happens to the effectiveness of mom's control in the family when that happens? Yeah. It goes down. It does, you know, it doesn't make things go better. It simply makes things go worse. the children are not looking at mom the same way as when she's got love in her heart and she's in control and she's helping them and the environment is right and there's expectations and they have to meet them. Now it's a different thing. Husbands, dads can do this, wives can do this, and when it happens, it really decreases the effectiveness of our ability. And so we need to use better self-control so that our voices... Have you ever noticed this? Sometimes it's easier for us to be polite to people we don't even know than people in our own family. You go to the bank, you go to the grocery store, you go to the gas station, and you may be having a rough day, but you're able to walk up to a complete stranger and say thank you and please and have a good day. But then sometimes with our own children or our own wives or our own husbands, we can stop doing those little kid, Luke's had a little book, The Polite Elephant, just kind of rules, but we stop being polite elephants, and that's not a good thing. Proverbs 14:1, the wise woman builds her house. The foolish tears it down with her own hands. Have you ever seen women do that? You ever watched a woman just tear down her home and destroy it? Proverbs chapter 21, verse 9 and 19. You recall these verses. It is better to live in a corner of a housetop than in a house shared with a quarrelsome wife. Verse 19. It is better to live in a desert land than with a quarrelsome and fretful woman. And Solomon had a lot of wives, so if you had several of them that were quarrelsome, you'd really need some desert. In Titus chapter 2, turn to this passage and look at it with me. And the first thing I want you to notice here is what this says about doctrine. Often, we misuse, well, I don't know that we misuse, but we put a meaning on the word doctrine that is narrower than is in the Bible. We tend to use the word doctrine to refer to what? Either matters of theology or the organization and work and worship of the church. That's doctrine. Those are moral things, and those are practical things. This is doctrine. And so we talk sometimes about sound doctrine. And when we talk about sound doctrine, you know, we might think, well, you want to have the Lord's Supper on the first day of the week, you know, pour out, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Look what the Bible says here about sound doctrine. King James and the American Standard, some your translation may say teaching. That's all doctrine is, teaching. And some teaching is on how to do the Lord's Supper, and some teaching is like, tell the truth. Look at this passage. Speak thou, this is Titus chapter 2, verse 1, speak thou the things that befit the sound doctrine. Aged men should be temperate, grave, sober-minded, sound in faith, in love, in patience. That's sound doctrine. You know, you might have a church where they assemble, they sing psalms, hymns, and praises to God, they take the Lord's Supper on the first of the week, and the things that they call doctrine they might have down, but if the character and the family life of the congregation is horrible, is that sound doctrine? Sound doctrine. Aged women, likewise, be reverent in demeanor. Not in slanders, nor enslaved to much wine, teachers of what is good, that they may train the young women to love their husbands, to love their children, to be sober-minded, chaste, workers at home, kind, being in subjection to their husbands, that the word of God be not blasphemed. The younger men likewise exhort to be sober-minded in all things, showing yourselves an example of good works and doctrine, showing uncorruptness, gravity, etc., etc. First off, notice that this is something you can train, and it's a job given to older women. Older women train the younger women to do these things. And this is a job that needs to be done perhaps now more than ever. I want you to think about this. Every once in a while now you read about somebody over 100 years old, somebody 113 or 15 died the other day. That's somebody born right around 1900. I don't know when there will be a time that the world will change as much as between, say, 1900 and 2013. You're talking about somebody when they were born, you would have gone around by horse. And, I mean, some places you would have had some of our modern conveniences, you know, lines and different things and electricity. But for a lot of people, you would have been without electricity, without indoor plumbing, getting around by horse, et cetera, all the way up into the computer age. It's always been important to train children and raise children. But in times past, when the world was changing less quickly, don't you imagine that it was simpler for a son to follow in his father's footsteps? If your father was a cobbler, you might be a cobbler. If your father was a blacksmith, then he, you know, brings you into the business and you learn, and you're the next generation blacksmith. But we're in a society now, and so you would have probably seen more often a, you know, the acorn doesn't fall far from the tree. But now there's so many things competing for that acorn. So many things trying to get it as far away from the tree as possible. You know, get to schools. Get, as soon as the baby is born, get him in daycare as quick as possible, so where strangers are watching over him. And there's some scary things happening in daycare. I've got some friends that run one. And it's, let me just take a second to mention that. And it ties to this being workers at home. I know a couple that run a very small daycare. Fine couple, they love children. Not everybody that's run a daycare loves children. I talked to one lady in South Carolina that ran one, and she said, I try to do a good job. She said, I used to work in a daycare where my job was to crudely color pictures so that we would hand them out to parents when they came and say, look what your child did today. Said, you know, babies would lay there for hours just crying and banging their heads on the wall and stuff. Said, one time it was my job, I was told after one of the workers had hit a child and left it bruised in the face, I was told to explain to the parent that they fell off the slide. The people that I know, this other couple that runs a small daycare, very few children, elderly couple with no children, and I'm glad they're there for some of those children because I think some of those children parents don't care much about them, and this couple does. But they came in one time and they found a 6-year-old using a 3-year-old in a very unnatural way that would have never, ever occurred to a 6-year-old and was obviously the result of other things. It turned out that 6-year-old was in a family where the babysitters would be hired from a family whose lifestyle was so perverse, and I'm trying to keep language where adults will understand if you won't, where children were present and witness for the activities of the parents. There's a lot of perversity out there, and you don't know where it's at. But if you've got 30 kids in a daycare room, some of those kids have been exposed to some things that are coming from some dangerous families. And they were told when they reported this, I don't remember if it was a government thing or a corporate thing above them, licensing thing or whichever, they were told by the authorities above them, the thing to do is to keep it quiet. Not tell the parents of the other children what had happened. These people didn't do that. They did the right thing. They told everybody. The child had done this, removed, and then they made changes to, so that that type of, you know, better supervision, that type of thing couldn't occur in this, by this all. And they told the other parents what happened so the other parents could make the decision. But you know what? they're frustrated sometimes because when people call up and want to put their children in their daycare, some of the parents resent it that they want to meet with the parents. I have to come? These are people that want to take their small child and drop it off with a stranger for money, and they consider it an imposition on their time that they would need to meet with them. But that's kind of the standard now. You drop the kid off at daycare, and then as soon as possible, get them in preschool, and then as soon as possible, get them in the school. And then, oh, hopefully they're putting more and more programs into the afternoon so that we don't have to worry about where they're going to be. And you'll have people, I wouldn't be surprised before long, oh, let's just make school year-round because we wouldn't have to pay for daycare in the summer if we could just have the government take care of it there. And there was a woman that, I'll talk about this tomorrow night on time, or tomorrow morning, so I won't go into it now. But it's just a question of, do parents make a difference? I'll just say this much now. In a lot of cases, they don't. They don't make any difference because they're not there for the children. If you're not there for the children, you're not going to make a difference. Older women, train the younger women to love their husbands, love their children, be sensible, pure, works at home, kind, being subject to their husbands. On the thing about training them to love their husband, I want to share a funny story. I don't know that it's true. It's probably just an anecdote, but there's some truth in it. Maybe it's true. One anecdote I thought wasn't true, I found out was, because the lady in the audience said, yeah, my husband's the one that saw that happen. But this one involves a woman that wants to divorce her husband. And she goes to the lawyer, and she says, I want to know the most painful way to, you know, divorce my husband. He said, okay. He said, does he know yet that you're going to file the paperwork? She said, not yet. He said, perfect. Don't tell him. Instead, you just start being as sweet and nice as you can be. You know, you kiss him in the morning as he leaves for work. You know, say, tell him you're looking forward to seeing him. Put love note in his lunchbox. You know, make him an apple pie. You know, rub his feet. You just really treat him like a king. For a few weeks, he'll be riding high and thinks everything's okay. Then, bam! You serve him with the papers, and he'll never recover from that crushing blow. She says, yeah, I'll do that. And then a few weeks later, she doesn't come back. Weeks go by, she still doesn't come back. Eventually, he sees a woman in town. He says, when you come, are you crazy? We're the happiest we've ever been. You remember when we talked about God so love that he gave. When you give, when husbands give to the wives, then the wives give. When wives give to the husbands, then the husbands give. When the family gives to each other. You know, one of the beautiful things about children is when they start enjoying giving presents. You notice that? Oh, it's his birthday. I want to get him this. I want to get him. Isn't that a beautiful thing? What did Jesus say? It's more blessed to give than receive. Older women have been married to imperfect men. Older women have gone through, you know, different things. And they can help train younger women to love their husbands, love their children, be sensible, pure. We'll be talking some tomorrow about the issue of pornography and a great deal of the impurity that comes from that. There's a lot of impurity going around for young women now, and older women as well. One of the things, you look at the statistics, and I don't want to say much as well because we'll talk more about this tomorrow, but with women, it's getting online and chatting. And feeling, my husband doesn't listen to me enough, and getting online and finding somebody ready to listen. He's ready to listen. He may be lying about who he is. He may be giving you a lot of lines. He may be telling you he's not married and he is. He may be telling you he's wealthy and he's not. You know, it's plenty of lies. But, oh, he's going, and women get involved in emotional affairs before there's ever a physical affair. And probably some of you have known and heard of cases of a woman who ups and leaves her family and her children to go off and be with a man she's never even met. But she's been chatting on, you know, late at night, she's been chatting online with this fellow. Some of the books and romance novels and just other things, some of the artificialness of just in the fantasy lives of some people where they want to pretend that their spouse is somebody else or that they're somebody else. A lot of people want to be famous now. I heard that a significant portion of Americans think at some point in their life they're going to be famous. That's not going to happen. And good. Good. Fame has made a mess of a lot of people. But people that get infatuated with the stars on TV and this person and that person, live your own life. Enjoy your own life. Husband, love your own wife. Wife, love your own husband. That's your story. Don't get infatuated with somebody else's story. Don't wish that you were in somebody else's story. Make your story the story that you want to be in. God gave us this great blessing. Love your husband. Love your children. Be sensible, pure workers at home. Kind, being in subjection to their own husbands. I want to say one other thing on that, workers at home. When Mike Maher and I, over in the Czech Republic, years ago, back in 91, we were invited over to some agnostics. They weren't believers, but they invited us over for lunch. And we enjoyed lunch with them, and then went on about a three-hour hike. And coming back, she asked a question. And before I tell you the question she asked, I want to describe their economic situation. He made, his salary, annual, was $1,500. That was his annual salary. She worked also, and that was her annual salary. They said their apartment was clean. And they would vacation. They would vacation in Switzerland. You'd say, how could you vacation? Because in their work, they had connection with the railroads, and so they could get discounted travel, and they would not sleep in a hotel. They'd sleep on the ground in the park, and they would not eat food there. They would take bread from the Czech Republic. So they didn't spend money there. They went to Switzerland, and they saw Switzerland, ate their bread, slept in the park, and went back home. She said, every once in a while, I will buy a bell pepper because my daughters love bell peppers. And I'll split it, and each girl got one half of a bell pepper. Because bell peppers were expensive for her. They told us about a restaurant. They said, oh, you have to try the India restaurant on Wenceslas Square, just off of Wenceslas Square. It's our favorite restaurant. You know, we go there once a year. And they corrected him and said, well, this, except last year we didn't go. You know why they didn't go last year? The prices had gone up. In our equivalent, the price had gone up $1.50. So that year, they didn't go to their restaurant. We're all out for a walk. And as we come back, she says, may I ask you a question? She said, most women in America, do they work? We said, yes, they do. She said, do they do it because they want to or because they have to? She says, I do it because I have to. I wish I could be at home with my girls, but I can't. What she wanted to know is, do women in America do it because they want to or because they have to? I think there's a lot of women who tell themselves, and a lot of young men who tell themselves, oh, we have to have these dual income. And there are some incomes that still allow for a woman to really be dedicated in the home. But there's a lot where it's just going to really interfere of it and not have her in the home. And a lot of well, we have to, because otherwise how can we afford this house and this style of living and it, when you got cable and you got, you know, that's, have you noticed now that that's a necessity of life? You get a call from somebody wanting money, you know, and they call up and you go over there and see if they need some groceries from them. They're sitting there in the middle of the day watching cable. You know, it's just like, that woman's question, considering who she was in her circumstances, powerful question. Kind, being in subjection to their own husbands. Remember in Genesis 3, that there's over, husbands, please help change diapers. You know, the wife can help bring in some money. The husband can help out with that. But remember the basic gender roles there. And these things there. And what Underwood is married, ruling the house, etc. Let's talk now about some marital pitfalls before we wind up this evening. Number one, the physical relationship. 1 Corinthians 7, and I'll be specific here without, on matters like this, I like to talk at a level that adults know what we're talking about without necessarily embarrassing children or others. 1 Corinthians 7 says, defraud not one the other. Husband, your body does not belong to you, it belongs to your wife. Wife, your body does not belong to you, it belongs to your husband. Do you remember what we said when we got married? Do you take this person to be your lawfully wed wife, to have and to hold and to keep yourself to him and him alone? Do you tend to keep yourself to her and her alone? Every once in a while, you'll see a marriage where, after a little while, one of the people just decides they just want to be roommates. That's not what the agreement was. That's not what this one flesh relationship was about. The husband, he's given his self and his body to his wife. It belongs to her. The wife, she's given herself and her body to the husband. It belongs to him. This one flesh plan of God includes this physical relationship. And I want you to think about how fundamental and beneficial it is. I think about like a combustion engine. I want you to think about the fact that the more you're around somebody, the more you have the potential to be annoyed by that person. You can take two people that are good friends, or at least fine acquaintances, and if they go on a 3,000-mile road trip together, at some point, they're going to notice that the other one has a little bit of, you know, quirk that they don't like. Well, when you take a man who is one type of critter and a woman who is a different type, and you put them in a marriage, with their emotional differences and everything is not always smooth. In an engine, you have tight tolerances, close tolerances, and the potential for a lot of heat and friction, and so it has a radiator, and it has oil to keep things cooled down. That's important, because in close quarters, otherwise you get a lot of friction. The romantic part of marriage is one of the things that helps make and keep in a very comfortable level the relationship that sometimes will have bumps and other frictions. And so it's a point at which the people can give themselves to each other and there can be a closeness and an intimacy that can help erase. There's this chemical bondings that take place, and it's valuable, and God put it here. It should be considerate. And these passages here apply to business and how you treat your customers. It applies to how you treat your siblings. It applies to how you treat your neighbor, how you treat your kids, and how you treat your spouse in these things. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Don't look just to your own things. Look to the things of others. Consider other better than self. You know, that's going to be valuable within the marriage. Secure. the heart of her husband trusts in her. Don't pay attention to another woman. Rejoice, be intoxicated in the wife of your youth. Impassioned, in that passage I just mentioned, loving. These principles will help make that be. Avoiding pitfalls in communication. Remember it said, according to knowledge. Proverbs 18:13 warns against the foolishness of answering without hearing. You know, a lot of Proverbs is about don't be too quick to speak. In the multitudes of words, there lacks not transgression. Destructive communication. Proverbs chapter 12, verse 18. There is one whose rash words are like sword thrusts, but the tongue of the wise brings healing. Do we know how to say things that would hurt our spouse? The words of the wise bring healing, not jabbing and going for buttons. Proverbs chapter 15, verse 1. A soft answer turns away wrath. Harsh words stir up anger. Somebody described an argument as two people talking and nobody listening. And that's a pretty common, you know, apt description of what often happens. You put the bit in the horse's mouth and that's going to control where he goes. So the tongue is a little member but makes such a great difference. We're to speak the truth in love. Proverbs 25 says a soft tongue breaks the bone. Proverbs 15, the one we just saw, soft answer turns away wrath. The power of life and death are in the tongue. That old saying, sticks and stones break my bones, but words can never hurt me. That's not true. Some of the things that we have been most helped by have been what things that have been said to us, and some of the things we have been most hurt by are things that have been said to us. If you want to tear somebody up, you can do it with words. If you want to destroy somebody's reputation, you can go out here and a good reputation, rightly owned by a person who has lived right for years, you can go out here and start telling lies and accusing them of treacherous things and destroy their reputation in no time. Words are hurtful things when they're used wrong. The law of kindness on the tongue. Some specific areas as we wind up here. We're going to talk about apologies for a minute and then a couple final things. Not every apology. We talked last night about some people don't apologize. Then sometimes they do, but they don't like it. Have you ever seen a kid that doesn't want to eat his Brussels sprouts and mom says, you have to? And so it's like, you know, it doesn't make it better. That's how an apology comes out of some people's mouth. There's the minimizing apology. Perhaps I did make a mistake. Maybe my reaction wasn't the best. Well, no one's perfect after all. In other words, maybe I wasn't quite perfect. Nobody thought you were. You know, when I owe Bertina an apology, suggesting to her that I might not be perfect is not a big revelation. There's the accusation apology. I'm sorry you got so upset over that. I'm sorry you were so bothered by that. I'm sorry you took it the wrong way. In other words, here's your apology. Sorry you messed up, but it's your fault. Those are not apologies. Those are accusations. They had the word sorry in it. So does, you're a sorry excuse for a person. That has the word sorry in it, but it's not an apology. The hypothetical apology. If I may have made a mistake, if I did anything that appeared to be wrong, in other words, I'm admitting nothing and likely did nothing, but supposing even if I did, let's consider it apologize for. The I'm sorry but apology. Well, I'm sorry, but if you hadn't, I'm sorry, but you are the one, I'm sorry, but I only reacted that way because you, what does that do to the apology? It just guts it. Because you saw, well, okay, let me real quick get out of the way. I'm sorry. And now there's this. Here's something that works better. Because you say, well, I kind of am sorry, but it was their fault because they did this and they did that. Well, if you want them to think about it, here would be a way that would work better. I'd like you to think about whether or not what you said was fair. But regardless of that, I know what I said wasn't fair, and I'm sorry. I'd like you to think about whether or not, you know, you were handling this in a right way. But regardless of that, I'm sorry I spoke in this way, and I shouldn't have done that, and I'm sorry. In both cases, you've given them something to think about, and you've said, I'm sorry, but do you see the huge difference that makes? The one way, you kicked the apology out the window. With the other one, you said, here's something I want you to think about, but here's what I'm taking ownership for, and you're ending with that, I'm sorry for this. You know what that will often lead to? The other person realizing, and I'm sorry about the other. Then there's the angry apology. So I'm sorry, okay? Fine, I'm sorry. Are you satisfied? Already said I was sorry. Okay, I said the words, now get off my back. Compare that to the apology of the prodigal son. Luke chapter 15. By the way, parents, keep in mind when he came to himself. Look at the text and look at the last words before, because you know the story. He's a foolish, foolish boy, and then he turns repentant. You know, when it have the famine hit, he's feeding the pigs, wish he could feed them and everything. But please look at the last words before he came to himself. In verse 17 is when he came to himself. George, what's the last phrase before when he came to himself? Look at the end of verse 16. Luke 15.
The first part of verse 16.
Last part of verse 16.
Verse 16, no one's giving anything to it?
No one's giving anything to it. How many times have you seen parents that keep bailing out somebody? They're on drugs again. They got on probation again. On this again. Got fired again. Got caught stealing again. And they keep bailing them out. Keep bailing them out. Keep bailing them out. Keep bailing them out. Those aren't going to come to themselves properly. No one gave him anything, and he came to himself. And look what he says. When he came to himself, he said, how many hired servants of my father have bread enough and spare? Here I perish with hunger. I will arise and go to my father. I will say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and in your sight. I am no more worthy to be called your son. Make me as one of your hired servants. He arose, came to his father. Father was yet afar off. His father saw him moved with compassion, ran, kissed him on the neck. The son didn't say, oh, he's not mad. No. He went ahead and said it. Father, I have sinned against heaven and in your sight. I'm no more worthy to be called your son. And that's how we need to come to God. But that's an apology. Throwing jabs, you know, don't say things like, my mistake, I should have learned not to expect much by now. I shouldn't blame you. You got it honestly enough from your dad, mom, brother, sister. You know, I should have listened to you, my mother, when she warned me about you. You know, don't do those things. Let no corrupt speech proceed out of your mouth. Even on things like expressing preference, the husband can say, tuna again? Why can't we have something good like spaghetti and meatballs? Or he can say, I'm so tired of seeing you in that old jumper. Why don't you wear something different? Or he can say, what did you spend on the groceries? You think money grows on trees? Instead, if he said, you know what I'd love to have sometime too? Some of your spaghetti and meatballs. I really like the way he picks it. That's probably going to get you spaghetti and meatballs sooner, I'm guessing. We haven't been shopping in a while. Would you like to go to town soon and get a new outfit? It's probably going to be taken better than this. And this month's really tight. Let's figure out some ways to save money on gas and groceries this month. And if she's a good one, what is she going to do? She wants to help out. She wants to look at that. Okay, I can do this, and we can do that. And in other words, just the way we talk to each other is important. Mom, if you're saying, why do you kids have to be such pigs? Can't you ever pick up after yourselves? You know, you can make things fun. You can say with a smile, okay, kids, who would like to pick up all their things right now, or who would rather get in trouble first and still have to pick up their things afterwards? I recommend the person that's your choice. You know, go! And you're going to see some happy little kids running and racing to get their stuff put away. You know, just how we conduct ourselves can make a big difference. We should be, don't be competing instead of completing. Don't be drifting apart. Let's remember to let us be teams of one. Don't expect 50-50. When you shingle a roof, you don't say, okay, you got up to right there and this shingle's got up to right there. You're going to have leaks. You overlay. You don't, wow, that's his. No, you overlay. When the husband is overlaying and the wife is overlaying, things are getting covered. Nurture, neglect, build up or tear down, grow together or all cold. It's our differences. Thank you very much. I've gone long. I'll not be going as long, hopefully tomorrow, but thank you for your patience.